Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 60 minutes. Today's program is another in our ongoing series, The News in Review. We're going to be discussing a couple of cases. One's old, one's brand new. O.J. Simpson and Drew Peterson. Actually, they're both old when you get right down to it. Joining me in the studio is my wife, Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Simon. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
From New York. I'm not sure if he's on the line yet, but we should have Denny Griffin. Denny followed the Las Vegas trial of O.J. pretty closely. So hopefully he will be joining us in the next couple of minutes. From Gainesville, Florida, we have the news director for Sky 97.3 News Talk Radio, TJ Hart. TJ, it's always good to talk to you.
Good afternoon. This is going to be an exciting show.
Oh, I can't wait. is that Pickles on the line?
Yes, you've been blessed with the pickle.
Okay, so from the Pacific Northwest, we have our regular commenter and writer on Blogger News, Ms. Pickles. So hello, Ms. Pickles.
Hello.
All right, and I am hoping that Art Harris will be able to join us. I know that he has a scheduling conflict. I got off the phone with him just a few minutes ago. He's going to try and wrap up a meeting early and join us midway through. And like any good, bad penny, here is Art Harris. Art, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I was just explaining what a weasel you were, and you know you had this meeting to attend.
Canceled it. Figured your show was more important, so I just wanted you to know that.
There you go. And last, but by no means least, from Los Angeles, we have attorney Peter Haven. Peter Haven is one of the attorneys tasked with ferreting out O.J.'s stash of cash to satisfy the civil trial award that was given to the Goldman family. Hello, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Simon. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Our phone lines are open, and we welcome your comments and questions. And with this powerhouse of guests, I'll just bet we have the answer to almost any question you have. So why don't you give us a call? On our switchboard number is area code 646-378-1120. Okay, on with the program. Peter, let's kick off with you. What's new in the search for the pot of OJ Gold?
Well, in all honesty, the search is sort of waning, and the most serious efforts that we had in the last several years involved him creating an asset and putting it out there for exposure, and that was his book, If I Did It. And most of our efforts during the last 2 or 3 years were concentrated on getting that book, which I believe led to certain developments in Vegas, but that's a whole nother topic. But after the Vegas conviction, we've concentrated on trying to get a hold of the memorabilia, which was the subject matter of that criminal proceeding, the stuff in the hotel room. And we've essentially secured that. It's basically annexed right now in Las Vegas, but at some point it'll be dispatched over to us, and we may try to market it or sell it somehow. I don't know how we're really going to do that. We've also been involved in litigation recently with Mike Gilbert. Mike Gilbert is O.J. Simpson's former agent and close confidant to Simpson for many years, and he was very deep in the Simpson camp when Simpson was initially tried for the murders here in Los Angeles in the early to mid-1990s. And then after many years, Gilbert had a big falling out with Simpson, and he more or less separated himself. And when we listen to those these audio tapes of what happened in Vegas, one of the first things that Simpson said when he busted into the room was, "Where's Mike Gilbert?" And Gilbert had a number of Simpson memorabilia items, and he basically said publicly that he was going to turn these over to us, and he hasn't done it yet, so we're involved in litigation with him. One of the items that Gilbert may or may not have is something that's referred to as the acquittal suit, and this was the suit that Simpson wore on the day that he had his he was acquitted in the first criminal trial, and you know, it's the one, it's sort of the recognizable thing. Now, I personally don't know why some items like that appear to have value, but you know, apparently things like the acquittal suit appear to have value. So we may or may not acquire some or all of these items, and we may or may not be able to liquidate them and sell them in some manner and make some amount of money. But on the whole, these are all very, really sort of small value items, and really the whole effort to chase assets is more or less winding down. There's just not much more that we can really do. And unless there's some asset that surfaces, or that we're made aware of somehow, of some significance. You know, when he created that book, that was a significant asset, and it just, you know, it exposed him, because it was an asset that he created and he put out there, and it was something that we could go after. But other than something like that that's brought to our attention, there really aren't many more targets to go after as far as trying to get things of value, seize them, and then liquidate them to partially satisfy the judgment. The judgment now is well over $40 million just for the Goldmans alone. It was originally about $19 million, and under California law, it grows at the interest rate of 10% per year. So over more than a decade, it has more than doubled. So, you know, we're never going to get anywhere near those kind of numbers.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Yeah, Peter. Hey, it's Art Harris here. I covered you know, Simpson's first trial for CNN as investigative correspondent, and then part of OJ too. And I was just always fascinated by the, you know, by the quest for justice. And that, isn't that really what it's about, more than money?
Well, it is. Unfortunately, in this context, the only justice that has been rendered is a judgment for money. And unfortunately, in the legal system, when you're dealing with criminal justice and the criminal system, justice is meted out in a very different way. It's justice in the form of imprisonment for serious crimes, and sometimes even capital punishment for extremely serious crimes like double murder. But when the criminal justice system does not result in a conviction, if you have a wealthy defendant, then your only other recourse is to pursue justice in the civil litigation system, which is basically money. And it's a true statement that every time a murder or a horrible crime is committed, there's not only a criminal claim, but there's also a civil claim that exists against every one of these perpetrators of these kinds of crimes. It's just that 99.9% of people who do these sort of things really don't have any kind of appreciable asset, or they end up in jail, or both, and there's just no point in bringing a civil case against them. There's no, quote-unquote, money in it. But the short answer to your question is that in this case, the only real justice that was ever rendered by the legal system was the civil judgment. But I do agree with you that you know, the search for justice and/or the search for money, however you define it, they're both winding down because of the events that have happened. He was convicted of something else, and he's more or less been given a life sentence for that crime in Vegas. So the whole thing is winding down.
Yeah, Peter, it's funny. I mean, when I was covering it, you know, people who knew O.J. Were saying that perhaps the worst punishment was for him to have to play golf on a public course for a change. So, you know, being forced, you know, to live a less spotlighted life, you know, even though he's still considered a bizarre celebrity wherever he used to go, I was amazed at the number of women who I interviewed after the first acquittal who wanted to date him. And I would ask them, but why? I mean, he's already killed one woman, and you have blonde, you look a lot like Nicole. He said, well, I don't think he would kill me. So there is this, you know, bizarre streak of pop culture OJ. Did that hinder you in any way? And I'm also wondering why you can't go after his football, I guess, the steady flow of funds he gets from his retirement account.
Well, those are two very good questions, and they're certainly ones that I and we have all wrestled with. First of all, with respect to the what I would call the charisma factor of O.J. Simpson, you know, I believe that human beings are naturally drawn to certain character traits. And when we see certain character traits in people, we feel a kind of deep impulse that makes us drawn to them. And, you know, you can talk about what these character traits are. I mean, sometimes it's appearance, it's stature, it's success. Sometimes it's just things like the voice. You know, a voice can be a very charismatic character trait. O.J. Simpson, in my humble opinion, packaged together most, if not all, of these character traits more so than almost any other human being that I can think of in the last, 20 or 30 years. Yeah, he has tremendous presence and tremendous charisma, and there's a kind of instinctive desire to want to like someone like that. But unfortunately, with that kind of absolute power, there often is absolute corruption, and he has demonstrated himself to be someone who's really kind of, I think he kind of feels so above people that people cease to have much value to him. They're not really human beings to him. They're sort of objects. The short answer is that yes, it's something you have to deal with because there's always a tremendous internal human desire to basically want to like this person and basically want to not believe that he did these sort of things. But over time, it becomes more and more apparent, you know, exactly what he is. And as his luster has faded over the years, a lot of it has eroded, but I don't think he mentally feels that he's lost some of these charisma and character traits. So it's very difficult, but over time, I do believe that in almost all circumstances, as long as you're pursuing justice, over time, justice is eventually served, as it was here, and he was very much brought down by the very same, you know, sort of ego character traits that also made him very strong and powerful. And if you saw his little speech at his criminal sentencing, I mean, he still has a lot of that power left, but it can't stand the test of time, and it can't stand up to constantly doing things which fly in the face of the law. Anybody who does that is sooner or later going to pay the price, and he did it. Now, quickly on the pensions, there are actually several things going on with the pensions. The murders were committed in 1994. The criminal proceedings got started shortly thereafter, and I suppose they wound down in, I'm thinking, 95, 96. And then there was a lag between the criminal the end of the criminal prosecutions, and then the commencement and the conclusion of the civil lawsuit, which basically picked up immediately after the criminal case ended. And
by
in that,
Petricelli. Yeah.
Pardon me?
Petricelli, yeah.
By Petricelli and the law firm of Mitchell, Silberberg, and Knupp, which did an outstanding job. In that time period, what you've got is you've got a man who has a lot of wealth. He had a good legal team. He had good advisors. He had lots of time to plan and prepare for the likelihood that there was going to be a very large civil judgment entered against him. And one of the things that Simpson did during this time period is he created a lot of tiny little companies, and he made himself an employee of these companies. These companies had things like names like O.J. Simpson, Inc. and Orenthal James Productions. They were basically legitimately created companies. They had some pseudo-legitimate purpose, which basically entailed, you know, handling his publicity or memorabilia or what have you. And then he took a lot of his money and he created pension plans in all of these little companies. There are about four or five little companies. And he put large amounts of money into these separate companies as pensions, and then he retired. And then he started collecting pensions from these companies that he had created and that he had funded. His NFL pension actually isn't that large, but his total pension package is considerable. And before he was convicted, we had evidence that indicated he was basically earning about $400,000 a year from these pensions. Under California law, pensions are exempt from judgment enforcement. We cannot go after pension proceeds to satisfy a civil debt, and that applies to, you know, any context. That's just a standard rule of law, and it pretty much exists in every state in the United States. So with pensions, we can't get any of that.
What about when he was selling under the table? This is fascinating. He would hold these big autograph sessions, and he was paid in cash. How hard was that for you to chase down? Do you have any idea how much he was actually making at these memorabilia conventions?
Well, I had a conversation with Gilbert about 2 years ago about this subject, and he talked to me openly about these sort of bags and satchels of cash, which would sort of move around from person to person and end up in Simpson's hands. The short answer to your question is, how difficult is it to get that? It's almost impossible. It's almost impossible, and this is why. You know, if he goes to do an autograph signing, it doesn't matter where it is. Let's just say it's Michigan, just to pick a place. And he's going there, and there's an understanding in the works that he's going to be paid. But he's not going to be paid directly, and he's not going to be paid by check, and he's not going to be paid by wire transfer. That some of the proceeds of these conventions are going to basically be converted into cash, and they're going to be put in some sort of duffel bag. And at some point before he leaves, some satchel of cash is going to make his way into his possession. In order to really intercept that, we have to know when, where, how much, what's going to happen, and then we have to have court authority to be there and intercept it. And obviously, if we show up and we have some sheriff in hand, assuming we could accomplish all of that, the satchel of cash isn't going to materialize at that moment. It's going to be sidetracked. And it's almost impossible to get an order to go track something that you don't even know what it is. And it's even more difficult to enforce it. And the expense of such a thing is considerable. And the reward is almost illusory. So it's almost impossible to go after things like that. And
did you ever approach the IRS? I mean, it seemed to me, if he's getting all this cash, were you ever able to get a copy of his tax returns to see how much he actually put down from these events? And if so, if there was some suspicion he was making a lot more, I'm wondering if you ever got any interest in the IRS for them to do some sort of undercover operation. It would surely be quite a publicity stunt.
The IRS and the California Franchise Tax Board have both listed Simpson as one of the biggest avoiders of tax payments. And they, for many years, have basically alleged or calculated that he owes them a lot of money. But they don't seem to really do anything about it. And I'm not faulting the IRS or the California Franchise Tax Board. They make calculated decisions as well. And like us, they're just another judgment creditor. They're just another person out there that he owes money to. And the only way they're ever going to get money from him, they can't go after his pension either, and they can't take his home away from him because his home in Florida is exempt. So all this cash under the table stuff, it's impossible to really measure or calculate, and they've made the same sort of business judgment decision that we've had to make, is that the effort and energy of going after it isn't going to lead to any results. I can't speak for the IRS or the California Franchise Tax Board, but they have looked at him for years, and they've basically, I think, thrown up their hands and said there's nothing we can do.
Okay, I need to jump in here. I know we have callers waiting, And I do ask your patience. And if you do want to call in, we will get to you. And the dial-in number is 646-378-1120. TJ, I want to bring you in on this.
Yes.
I don't know how much you have followed the O.J. Simpson story, but you must have some questions for Peter or some thoughts.
Well, right now it just seems to be you're right now at the most difficult part of this. I mean, the IRS has gone after him, everyone has gone after him, yet justice has not yet been served. It just seems to be there's got to be another rock or two that could be looked under in order to find some assets to satisfy this.
Well,
it just seems to be such a you must be going through such a real pain with this. I feel for you.
No, I don't think so. I actually think that personally, I actually feel like as much justice as can be served as possible has been served. I really believe that. I mean, the real form of justice would have been for him to pay for the murders. He was able to escape that, but not entirely escape that. And for a long time, the only justice that there was a civil monetary judgment.
Well, certainly, because the other one was a sham. In fact, I was at the Hobby Airport in Houston watching Johnny Cochran do the gloves thing. If it does not fit, you must acquit. And I got to tell you, that was the most polarized place on earth when that was being played on the televisions. I mean, right then and there, you could tell who was Caucasian and who was African-American, and you really didn't have to have your eyes open.
Well, it was a very polarizing trial, and it was a very polarizing time here in Los Angeles. And, we, in many respects, like probably a lot of major American cities, we had a very much of a division issue, and it manifested itself in that trial. Whatever happened, and it's not easy to always read the thoughts and minds of everyone, but it was what it was, and nothing more could be done about it except pursue the civil judgment. But now, going back to that civil judgment, he's in jail. He may never get out of jail. I mean, he's 60-some-odd years old. I don't know what his life expectancy is. He's going to have to spend at least 9 years in jail. He'll be over 70. Men in his demographic and that age don't have much of a life expectancy beyond 7 or 8 years. He may live a very long time, but he may not. And as far as assets go, there's really not a lot out there that we can identify. He has pensions, and the pensions, I presume, are basically funding his mortgage payment. And the pensions are untouchable, and the house can't be foreclosed upon.
Yeah,
and he's not going to be...
Florida,
yeah, because it's in Florida, because there's an unlimited homestead exemption. You can't foreclose on someone's home in Florida, no matter where the money came from. There just aren't any more targets out there that we know of. I don't think there are any offshore accounts, and even if there were, we don't know how to find them. I think his asset picture is pretty clear to us. It's protected, so it's fairly clear. There's just not much else to do right now, unless he steps out and does what he did before, which is create some asset and put it out there and expose it. Because once he did that, he stepped out of his little fortress, and that gave us something to go after.
The thing here in Florida is that, they feel for his kids. I mean, that's, up until the time he's incarcerated, he's been living down here. And they often feel for his kids. But I got to tell you, that celebrity thing ran out of gas a long time ago down here.
What do you mean, the celebrity thing?
With O.J., people wanting to kind of, like him, still like him, even though he's been in a lot of trouble and got off on the murder case. There was still some of that element that wanted to like the guy or have him like them. But I got to tell you, down here, it was like, get off the street, man. They didn't want to be seen with him. Nobody
did. I really do believe in the sense that justice is served in different ways. And in many
respects, that was one of them.
In many respects, the court of public opinion can be much harsher than the court of law. And the public, over time, more and more galvanized behind the point of view that he was a murderer and they were going to treat him like that. Now, there was always going to be sort of a minority faction of people that still gave in to their impulse to like him. But more and more people over time began to view him for what he was, an ostracized murderer who was thrown out of Los Angeles and took refuge in Florida. And I actually think that he really, really, really wanted to reclaim that spotlight or try to get himself back in some semblance of good favor with his following or the public. And I think that's why he wrote the book. And I really believe that when we took that book from him, we took away a kind of stage or format for him to try to redeem himself in the public eye. The whole purpose of the book was not to explain how he committed the murders, but why he committed them. He was trying to create an excuse so people could forgive him, in my opinion. And one of the interesting things that happened is that after we took that book, he really fought hard to keep us from taking it. I mean, he really fought us. Even though he had been paid about $630,000 in advance for it, and he got to keep that money, he still didn't want us to have the book. It was his stage. And the day we relaunched his book under basically our cover, that was the very same day that he busted into the Vegas hotel room. And he had told the FBI about 3 weeks before that event, he or one of his posse had told the FBI that they were going to do this. And they actually wanted it to be televised. There's no doubt in my mind that he wanted to try and reclaim his stage. And he thought, in my opinion, in his mind, that somehow this Vegas break-in was going to make him look like a hero and a victim, just like he hoped the book would make him look like a hero and a victim.
Actually, I want to interject here. I've read both versions of the book, and I really want to congratulate whoever did the cover art on it. It is so well done.
It is.
The book is titled If I Did It. The cover art has the word if in the smallest print you have ever seen in your life.
Well, it was a very much a collaborative effort, and there was a lot of sort of concern over how we were going to do the cover. The Goldmans had obviously issues and sensitivities to it, and they wanted to call it He Did It. And we had to explain to them, for all kinds of reasons, that we couldn't really change the title. We had to keep the title the way it was. And one of the arguments that I kept making is, this: when he had this book, it was his way of saying how he did it. He had control of his stage. And under his cover art, he had a big picture of himself that looked really nice. And I think he was actually wearing the acquittal suit. And the if was highlighted, but it was big. It was big. And he had control over the title, and he had control of the presentation, and it was all about, you know, did I really do this? And if I did, can you forgive me? When we took it over, what I wanted to do was have that if either – I wanted to get rid of the if altogether, or I wanted to have an if with just a red line through it, like a cross. And they convinced me to sort of put it in the eye. But what I really wanted to do was I wanted to create a book that had a title that screamed, I did it, because I wanted him to feel like every time he saw the title of that book, it was like him screaming out at the world, I did it. And I really do think that affected him. I really do think that. But, you know, obviously I'm biased. But the publisher, we had Eric Cantlin with Beaufort Books, and he had a lot of people who worked on that cover art, and my good friend David Cook was really into crime scene tape, and he wanted the whole thing to be wrapped in crime scene tape, and we had to kind of calm him down with that. We couldn't overdo it with crime scene tape. But the If I Did It was really a good stroke. We all knew we wanted to downplay the if somehow. It was just a question of how we were going to do it.
Oh, I think it's absolutely splendid, and I know Eric Kempman. You know, he's a very fine publisher. When I heard he was behind the project, I went, oh, yeah, this will be good.
Well, he was we were very fortunate to get him, and our literary agent, Charlene Martin, helped us secure a deal with Eric, and Eric was really the perfect man for this job, not the least reason of which is he was willing to do it. You know, at the time, this book was treason. This book was you know, it was taboo, and no publisher wanted to touch it. No literary agent wanted to touch it, and our clients were sort of partly responsible for that because they damned the book when it first came out, and we had
right.
to really try and explain to people, you know, mostly from a lawyer's point of view, why we had to do this. I mean, we had to do this. There wasn't any choice. We had to. And you know, it was a difficult process to turn the book around. And one of the key elements of turning the book around as far as presenting it as the opposite of what it originally was an appearance that we made on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And that appearance aired on that Thursday, the day the book was released, and that, again, was the same evening that he busted into the hotel room. These events, in my opinion, were not mere coincidences. He was trying to take away our stage and reclaim his.
Eric Kempman is an exciting author. His latest project was The Jewel of Medina, which...
Yeah.
caused a huge amount of trouble. Well, let's go to the lines for a minute. We have someone coming in from area code 636. What's your name and what's your question for us?
Hello, my name is Eric. I like turtles. I wanted to call in and ask you, as far as the book is concerned, if you go to page 43, where he talks about putting a cock in his mouth and he goes, whoa, how do you like that? I mean, I've tried to read that chapter a couple of times, and every time I can't get past that particular one. Thanks. I'll listen and hang up and listen.
I'm not sure. I would have to go drag the book off the shelf.
No, don't. That's not in the book.
Right. Yes, I do think maybe that was one of those strange callers. Art, I want to go back to you. I was talking to Peter yesterday, and we got off on the subject of how we have an imperfect jury system, and he made an interesting observation. Yeah, the system may be imperfect, but truth has a way of prevailing. And in fact, he cited O.J. and Drew Peterson as possible examples. You covered the original O.J. trial.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you were as shocked by the verdict as the rest of us. Yeah.
Well, I was. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit. I was, when the verdict came in, I was actually at Camp O.J. In a little tent with Greta Van Susteren, who at the time had a first CNN talk show, and I was sitting next to Dominic Dunn, the great Vanity Fair writer, you know, he was outraged because, you know, his daughter had been murdered, and he had not received justice in his, you know, in his view at all. And here he was, behind him in the streets was a jubilant crowd of O.J. fans, and he was so outraged that he called this on the air. He called this, you know, an act of anarchy. And Greta was, you know, so upset that, well, actually, she reacted in such a way that she called him an anarchist. If he ripped his microphone off and walked off the set live, we had to, you know, do a little tap dancing and fill in. But, you know, to get to that point, a number of things had to happen, Simon. Number one, Gil Garcetti.
Hello?
Nope. Am I still on? Are you there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello.
Garcetti had to pick the venue.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, Gil Garcetti had to pick, you know, it was going to be in Brentwood. You know, it was going to be up in Santa Monica where, you know, that's where he lived in a very nice neighborhood, and he was going to be tried by a jury of his peers. Only that was so politically risky for Garcetti, who I think faced in a re-election, that it was transferred downtown, majority African-American jury pool. And I was privy to how they picked the jury, Simon. I was pretty close. I had really good sources inside, you know, Johnny Cochran's defense team, Effley Bailey and others. And, you know, their ideal juror was a mother of sons who had experienced the wrath of the LAPD or knew somebody who had been roughed up in those good old days down there, or the Wild West, going into the hood and busting up some of the brothers. And so by picking this jury pool that was overwhelmingly African American and women, they had a total predisposition, not so much to love O.J., but as a reactive vote against a legacy of police brutality.
That's right. And I think that's a very important point, because justice is a very tough thing to try to get our heads around. And, you know, if you're God and you want to administer justice, you have perfect power and perfect vision and perfect knowledge, and you know exactly what to do. But we're all just human beings on this earth, and we're trying to do the best we can. And for that jury pool at that time, with this crime, after the Rodney King riots, after, you can say whatever you want about whether these things happened or didn't happen, but an entire class of people believed that they had been very much mistreated by this prosecutorial law enforcement arm of city government. And whether they were right or wrong in that belief, that was their belief, and a lot of people had that belief. And to expect that type of community to give you the verdict that you want in this type of case, under these facts, I had a strong feeling going into the trial, because I was here for the Rodney King riots. I was in law school at the time at UCLA, and I knew what the jury pool was going to be like, and I said from the very beginning, they're not going to get a conviction. And I told people that, and they didn't believe me, but I felt very strongly that they weren't going to get a conviction. And you can talk all about all the things and forces that went into play, but they were at play at the time. Now, so he was able to escape under those circumstances. When they brought the civil trial, they actually brought it in Santa Monica, and, you know, he basically got convicted. And it was very clear that the two venues were really the biggest reasons of all. And, you know, why they chose to do it in downtown, you know, they had a lot of reasons for doing it. Garcetti had to make a political decision. He didn't want another riot. He didn't want to be accused of, you know, stockpiling the jury. And also, it was a tremendous media circus, and there was a great perception that Santa Monica wasn't really built to deal with this kind of media circus. I don't think that's really true, but the downtown court system was perceived to have much better venue to deal with this great media circus that eventually developed.
Okay, let's quickly go to the phones. I think I have someone on a Skype line coming in from the mysterious 111 area code. What's your name and what's your question for us?
Hello?
Mr. Skype? Yep, you're on.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I was just wondering, how can I explain this? Do you think that O.J. Simpson, because, you know, he got off on the murder charge, and then, you know, he had the road rage case and a few other run-ins with the law, that he got really cocky thinking he was going to get off in Las Vegas?
I think that the combination of O.J. Simpson and Yale Galanter is a kind of very deadly legal combination, because Yale Galanter is his primary attorney, and Yale is often wrong but never in doubt. Yale is just so completely convinced that he's right. And Simpson, I think, also very much had a great deal of confidence in himself for all the reasons I talked about earlier. I mean, his whole life he had basically gotten what he had wanted, and I think it was difficult for him to fathom that he wasn't going to get that way again. So I do think there was a tremendous amount of overconfidence, and I think that he really thought, it wasn't so much thinking he was, I mean, when he went into that Vegas hotel room, which is really where the bad judgment started, I mean, I think he really believed that he was going to look good for doing this. Like, he was being a victim. People were stealing stuff from him, and he was a hero, and he was going to get it back. And I think he really believed that the book would do the same thing for him. And that belief, it's just a misguided belief. And you saw it when he got up there and spoke at his criminal sentencing. I mean, he really believed in his mind that people were going to feel sorry for him or like him, and I think he was incredibly overconfident. There's also a part of me that really wonders, at some level, given just the things he was doing in the last two or three years, writing this book and busting into this hotel room and giving that speech at his criminal sentencing, it makes me wonder if there wasn't a part of him that almost wanted this whole thing to end this way. And I don't know what to make of it. What he did was so crazy that at some level you have to wonder if some part of him didn't want it to turn out this way. I just don't know.
Well, I just want to say, I'm a female. I'm a physician's assistant, and I go to the jail out there once a month. And he's not doing that. He's doing very well out there.
Well, are they taking care of him?
Oh yeah, he's very well taken care of, and he's king of kings. He's
comfortable.
Yeah, and the commissary he buys for other inmates. He's got inmates under his belt that basically watch him, if you will. So he's pretty well taken care of. And did you hear that he fired Grasso?
Yes. Well, I don't believe that Simpson really fired Grasso. I believe that Galanter fired Grasso. And Galanter had the Galanter is, you know, if O.J. was going to be turned into a lawyer and manifest himself as a lawyer, it would be Yale Galanter. He's very confident. He really believes that everything he's doing is the right thing, and it's my understanding that he and Grasso sort of had a difference of opinion, which basically I read as Grasso says, "This is crazy. You got to do it this way," and Galanter says, "Nobody tells me what to do. I'm doing it my way," and Galanter basically let him go. I don't think Simpson per se fired him. Galanter did, and yes, I did hear that. And with respect to Simpson in jail being well treated, it doesn't surprise me at all. Again, I go back to the notion that there are some character traits that exist in people that people are drawn to and that they like. And O.J. has got a lot of those character traits, and there are always going to be people that like him. And quite frankly, if you didn't know he committed these murders and you were in his presence, you would find yourself liking him a great deal. And that goes for men and women alike. He was extremely well thought of for a long time. I mean, even after the murders, he still had a large following. He really is a pretty powerful figure, and it doesn't surprise me at all that he's getting good treatment.
I
can tell you one thing about the Gabe Grasso, situation. As you said, it was Galanter, but I can tell you it was more about money than anything else. And you will see a lawsuit, I'm told, very soon, by Gabe trying to get paid, frankly. And lawyer who I'm told is going to be standing in his shoes. First of all, the shoes won't fit, and they won't acquit. But he's a lot cheaper.
Well, let me tell you something. Here's the way it works in these high-profile cases. A guy like Yale Galanter, I'm sure at some level he gets paid something by O.J., but I really believe that Yale views O.J. as just a great big business card advertisement. I mean, it's better than putting your picture on the back of a bus. This guy gets Yale Galanter on TV all the time, and there are lawyers who would kill to get that kind of advertising. And I'm convinced that a lot of what Yale does is to basically generate promotion for himself. Simpson is notorious for not paying people. And it's not just us. It's everybody. It's taxes. It's the government. It's the bail bondsman who sprung him out of jail in Vegas. It's his lawyers. Lawyers get drawn into these cases because they're attracted to the allure. They may have agreements, and the agreement is with the client. It's not, I mean, I assume it's with Simpson. I don't think it's with Galanter. But the agreement is that Simpson's going to pay him X, Y, or Z. And guess what? Guess what? Simpson has no incentive. He doesn't care if you get a judgment against him. He doesn't care if you're one of the 8,000 creditors who are chasing him. His assets are protected. These people, when they get involved with him, and if they really think that they're going to get paid, they end up being unpleasantly surprised. And if they don't recognize that a large part of their compensation is the publicity, then they don't see the big picture. Yale does a great job of milking this case for everything it's worth publicity-wise.
Surprise, surprise! I'll tell you, the Vegas, his bondsman, who put up $250,000 to get
ended up ratting him out.
No. That was the first bondsman. Remember, yanked him back to Las Vegas when he called and made a threatening, call or two to some of the
co-conspirators. Yeah.
Right. And so he got yanked back, and then she doubled his bond. And Jason Riesbeck of a company called Vegas Bail, very colorful guy, drives a Porsche, a Hummer that's wrapped with Vegas Bail, 700 horsepower Mustang, who I got to know. In fact, we're doing a reality pilot together. He actually would not let OJ out of jail until he got paid his 15% up front. So he's 375.
He understood.
He may be the only one who got paid. So.
But people like the guy. They trust him. It's just like the women who were attracted to him. Oh, he's not going to do that to me. These bail bonds, like a lot of people deal with them, and I'm sure they think, oh, come on, he's not going to stiff me. But guess what? He will, and because he doesn't really have to. And if he had been acquitted, maybe he would have paid the guy. But in his thinking, I didn't get anything. Why should I pay you?
Okay, TJ, I want to bring you back in, because you were saying earlier in the show that Simpson had basically worn out his welcome in Florida.
Yes, it's that kind of familiarity, I guess, that would come with it. If you see somebody, like of his stature on the street for the first time, it's like, oh wow, that's OJ. But you know, when your neighbor's like, yeah, it's OJ.
it's
that familiarity thing, I believe.
After time, it wears off, and when you're not still the shining star, when you're the outcast, he still has a lot of those character traits, but he's no longer the NFL commentator. He's no longer in movies. He's no longer in advertisements. He's no longer Mr. Wonder Boy. He still has the character traits, but without the limelight illuminating him, it slowly starts to fade. And, of course, when you see him every day, the initial, oh, man, that's him thing wears off. And over time, it just kind of dissipates. And I think after 10 or 12 years, I mean, he really felt like he was no longer, he was kind of an outcast, an unimportant person. And I think he really wanted to reclaim that.
I think you're right.
That's why he wrote the book.
He
had nothing to lose in his mind. He had already been convicted in the public mind. He was living a kind of, he had enough money, but he had kind of a meaningless life. And he wanted to kind of do something. I think he felt that he was getting towards the end of his life, and he wanted to kind of try and redeem himself or capture the public mindset again. And he wasn't going to stop until he did it. And that's why he ended up in jail, in my opinion.
Peter, I can tell you that from someone who studied OJ for a number of years, I was privy to a phone call he made and was fascinated that he still believes that he's the cat's meow, and he actually said that Miami is my town, and he's offering to wine and dine someone after it was all over because he did expect to be acquitted. And he's a great rationalizer, and that is probably, as you said, why he was able to write this book, wanting people to think that somehow, somehow Nicole, quote, deserved it.
She
stepped out on him, and, that he was trying to rationalize this terrible act of violence because he felt aggrieved and was really a professional victim, at least in his mind. And I've never seen anyone, I've covered so many criminal trials and defendants, that was able to compartmentalize his brain in such a way that the guilt didn't trickle over into the next cell.
Well, human beings can accomplish a lot of amazing things, and I think over his lifetime he came to look at a lot of people as sort of little chess pieces, and I think when he broke and shattered and destroyed two of these chess pieces, I think a part of him may have felt bad about it, but over time he just kind of subordinated it, and he reverted to what's always been his mental state, which is, I'm a good guy, I'm a great guy, people love me, these people had it coming, I never wanted to be a bad guy, they brought it out of me, and then, he believes it,
Okay, we have a couple of questions coming in from the message board. Why is it that O.J. was able to keep the $600,000 book advance, and have the Goldmans actually made any money from the book?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. Yes, we have made some money from the book, and we had a lot of people who had to basically be compensated, but we sold, I would guess, anywhere from 150 to about 200,000 copies. At the end of the day, after the publisher was paid, after the literary agent was paid, after other people were paid, after the attorneys were paid, we had five sets of attorneys. Each of them had a percentage share of these proceeds. Fred has to deal with Ron's mother, and there are payments that need to be made to her because she also has a claim and entitlement to proceeds from her civil judgment. She has a separate and independent civil judgment. At the end of the day, I think the Goldmans will take anywhere from, I would venture to say, $100,000 to maybe $150,000 at the end of the day, which, quite frankly, considering the fact that they really didn't get a nickel from them before, I think it's a phenomenal success. It doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I actually think it is a lot of money, and I think it was a tremendous success in terms of what it ultimately accomplished in terms of getting justice. As far as the other question about, how he's able to basically protect his assets, that has to do with the fact that, he had a lot of time to prepare for it, and he has a completely protected home in Florida, and the only other identifiable source of income are his pension proceeds, and we really can't touch any of it.
Okay, let's go back to these assets. And this is, well, I'd say off the record, but it really isn't, because we're on the stinking radio. Do you believe that there's a big hidden stash?
No. No, I think that everything he's got is basically tied up in these pensions. The pensions are funded, and they have, I would say, I don't know, I think anywhere from $3 to $5 million of money is basically wrapped up in pensions. And these pensions are paying him chunks of money over time. I think he gets a check every month from these pensions. I think all his money is tied up in the pensions, and I think it's tied up in his home. I think his home, he purchased it for about $500,000, and now it's worth about $1 million, give or take. I don't think there is any big secret stash of money anywhere. I think it's all in the pensions, and I think it's all in the home, and I think it's all untouchable, unless he does something stupid.
Okay, I'm gonna throw out another question, and I'm gonna ask Peter to answer it first, and then I want to get Art and TJ to weigh in. OJ's appealed to the Nevada Supreme Court. Does he have any realistic chance of success?
In my opinion, none. He's basically challenging what we generally call constitutional due process. When you're accused of a crime, you have very severe penalties if you're convicted. And because the penalties are so severe, the Constitution requires that you be subjected to a pretty high degree of due process. We don't want to take away your freedom and your liberty unless we're pretty sure that we've done the best to ensure that you have a fair trial and lots of due process. Due process in this context includes proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It includes a jury trial. It includes all kinds of protections. He's claiming, in effect, that his constitutional due process was violated because the prosecutors and the police detectives and everybody in Vegas basically convicted him because he'd committed murder before. And they stacked the deck against him, and they tried to do everything they could to take him down, and that somehow they tampered or rigged the jury so that there wouldn't be any African-American, or there would be, they would mess with the numbers so that there wouldn't be an ethnically diverse mix of people on the jury that it would be a sort of stacked deck against him. Now, I believe it is true that the prosecutors did everything they could to convict him, but I'm certain that the prosecutors didn't do anything wrong in this case. I think everybody bent over backwards, the judge and the prosecutors, to make sure that everything was done as much by the book as possible. And any claim that there was some sort of systematic prejudice or something against him didn't impact the ultimate jury trial. Those prosecutors teed him up. They had a massive amount of evidence. They had a fair and impartial jury selection process. He's going to have real proof of bias and tampering or something like that on appeal. In my opinion, he has no chance of success.
Art, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing I would certainly agree with Peter. He had a great defense. He had the jury trial, and he was able to face all his accusers. Now, a lot of them were certainly very questionable characters, including the guy who blew the whistle, this Thomas Riccio, who actually set up the sting operation, was somebody who had had his tape recorder running. And, you know, I think if he could have made things happen and there was a shootout, imagine what it would have been worth. He sold, as it was, he sold the tape and rights to it for quite a fortune and then went on to do his own book.
Yeah,
but as far as and I wonder if maybe that's something that you've contemplated going after. But, as far as O.J. goes here, he's got to go through the motions. And something really interesting, I think, that a point Peter made is that for him, this is a lot about the stage he's on, and he's got to continue to play the victim. And if he didn't appeal and make a big deal over it, of course, he would not be playing the O.J. Simpson we've grown to love and hate. And so he's got to do that. Number two, in the process of all this, if you look at it, I think that a lot of people might agree that that could have been a sentiment running through the jury that we'll give him justice because it was not done before. But the evidence about him breaking in, about him leading the armed posse, there were two guys who were armed, Walt Alexander and I guess his other pal. Under the law and under, I think, what the judge read, a jury would have had to convict him even if they were swayed or were in his charisma path just by the way the law read. Isn't that right, Peter?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there are a few things you said there that are really worth emphasizing. The evidence against him was overwhelming, including evidence of his own statements that were, I believe, captured on audio tape, where he's basically telling a guy, "Did you get rid of the piece?" So it's clear what happened in that Vegas hotel room. It was crystal clear, all the evidence that was presented. He organized a group of people. He knew some of the people had guns. He went into it trying to make a big spectacle. And the thing about the job of a prosecutor in any town, once you've got clear evidence of a crime, you have to bring charges. You can't just say, "I'm not going to prosecute this case." In Vegas, this is the, I will call it the hospitality industry, for lack of a better word. I mean, they make their money providing adults with a place where they can go play and do almost anything that they want to do as long as they're safe. And it's the city of sin, no doubt, but it's got to be the city of safe sin. You can't allow people with guns in one hotel room while everybody's, yucking it up in the other hotel room. People come here to have a good time, and when you bring a gun into Vegas, into a hotel room, you threaten the entire Las Vegas community. You're really committing a crime against the lifeblood of the whole state. And these prosecutors, I'm sure they didn't want to try this case. I'm sure they would have loved to have done a plea deal. And I'll bet you if they had presented a plea deal to Simpson, he would have done maybe, 1 to 2 years of time, and then he would have gotten out. And I'm pretty certain that those plea deals were offered to him. In fact, I spoke with Detective, I think it was Detective Faulkner, on the Las Vegas prosecution. And the indications I had is that they talked about plea deals with him, but Yael Galanter and O.J. Simpson weren't going to take a plea deal. And they forced the prosecution to put their case on. They forced the prosecution to go the whole nine yards, and they had to put on a great case. They forced them to put on a great case, and they did put on a great case. There wasn't any bias. It was just a great prosecution, and they got the guy because he was guilty.
So once again, another case of hubris, overconfidence. I'm smarter, bigger, better, more of a victim than anybody.
It really makes you wonder, and again, I take a step back from all of this. I mean, O.J. is not a fool. And, you know, if you were really concerned about getting your sports memorabilia, I mean, if that's really all you worried about, I mean, he's had a history of getting cash duffel bags under the table and handed to him in secret, in confidence, in quiet. Why on earth would you stage this whole big production? It's almost as if the publicity was the most important thing. It isn't about actually, I mean, he really went out of his way to make this a big spectacle, a TV show. And then you saw it again at that criminal sentencing. I mean, there's something about him. This wasn't about getting the memorabilia. This was about getting back on the stage. And everything that he's doing, that he's done in these last 2 years, it sort of lends itself to that approach. So I don't know if it's hubris or just a misguided sense of what his real purpose is. It's probably everything, all of it.
Simon, I can give you a little backstory. Remember, he was in Vegas there to go to a friend's wedding, and there was quite the celebration. It wasn't so much that the bride and groom were the star, but that O.J. was the star, as you know, as Peter is suggesting. And, you know, there was a lot of drinking and there were a lot of partying, and his now ex-girlfriend was there, and with her low décolletage, you know, and this was, you know, a place where O.J., like a lot of adults when they go to Las Vegas, may have been affected by the I can do anything here. So if you layer on his I'm O.J. and I can do anything factor, you know, this is a guy who's out of control, who feels untouchable. That has something to do with it?
Yeah, I do, and I'll actually give a little bit of backstory to your backstory. He was at a wedding in Vegas. I believe it was the wedding of a guy from Miami who ran an auto salvage or mechanic shop or something. And when we were chasing him into bankruptcy, we tried to seize actually, there was an earlier question that I didn't quite answer, and I'll touch upon it now. He created a company to warehouse the book rights for the If I Did It book. And the company was basically paid by HarperCollins an advance for writing the book. And that advance was paid from the company, which was just a fraudulent corporate shell. It was paid in advance to Simpson before the book was even announced. So we couldn't chase that money because it was already spent and gone by the time we even knew about it. But when he created this book and we almost took it from him, his last-ditch effort to keep us from taking it from him was to put this company into bankruptcy in Miami. And that was actually the thing that gave us the book, because then we went to Miami and the bankruptcy court gave us the book. But in the course of investigating the assets of the company in Miami, we discovered that O.J. had a Lincoln Navigator that he was very, very fond of. It was really a prized possession of him, and he didn't want to see us get this Lincoln Navigator. And there was a chance in the bankruptcy proceeding that we were going to seize the Navigator and basically liquidate it. And he tried to hide the Navigator, and what he did was he took it to this auto yard, and he stashed it there, and it was the guy who owned the auto yard who was getting married in Vegas, and he was there for the wedding. I think the thing in Vegas about getting confident is definitely a part of it, but there's also, it's clear that he had been planning this event for some time, and I think getting the other people involved was a part of the whole Vegas atmosphere as well. You know, people said, "Oh, sure, we'll do it," because he has this tremendous ability to persuade people to do things.
Did you ever get the car?
The bankruptcy trustee located it, seized it, and I think what happened is they then did a settlement. I think at that point the car was only worth about $15,000 or $17,000, and somebody paid the bankruptcy trustee for the car. So I think he got to keep the Navigator. All they could have done was liquidate it and sell it anyway. So it didn't matter where the proceeds came from. So they got to keep the car, but they got the money.
Now he's got to pay for the gas, so you got that to stick.
Yeah, he's got to pay for the gas.
He's got to pay for the insurance as well.
Well, I think Arnell is probably driving that Navigator now. They probably own it free and clear.
Oh, man. There was another question that came up. The charges against OJ in Las Vegas, were they legitimate or were they blown out of proportion by some egotistical DA that just wanted to make a name for himself?
I think the charges were very legitimate. I do think that the case was blown out of proportion, but it was not blown out of proportion by an egotistical DA. It was blown out of proportion because it's OJ. And again, any other guy, first of all, this whole thing, in my opinion, was a great big publicity stunt. So OJ put in motion a giant publicity stunt that was intended to bring out a lot of publicity, and it did. And then after he got caught, he has that mugshot, and he's actually, you can see him basically smiling in that mugshot. He's very pleased with himself. And then, you know, there are these charges. Guns were used. A crime has clearly been committed. If this had been a thug, nobody defendant, you wouldn't have seen this great big publicity. You wouldn't have seen a massive arsenal of prosecutors going after him because the guy would have come in and copped a plea and, you know, maybe gotten off on 1 to 2 years, maybe gotten off with something less if he had no priors. It would have been dealt with in a very efficient and discreet fashion. But if this thing got big and if it got blown out of proportion, there was only one person who blew it out of proportion from the very beginning, and that was OJ himself. He forced the prosecutors to try him. And when you're going to take a case to trial, you have to present all your evidence. You have to put on your best case. You have to call all your witnesses. And if you're going to do all that, you press every single conceivable charge that is presented based upon the acts that have been committed. He forced them to go to war. And, you know, when you go to trial with OJ, you have to be prepared for a guy that you think people might like. You think people might let him off. You think that, you know, this is going to be on TV. Everyone's watching. This is a huge media circus. So you have to put all your resources into it. You just don't have a choice. And they did a great job, and they felt correctly that the world was watching, and they put on their best case, and they did an outstanding job. And the only person to blame for all of that happening is OJ himself. He had every opportunity to avoid all of this, and he never did. He forced them to do it. So it did get blown up and out of proportion. I mean, it's crazy to think about a man being sentenced to 10 to 30 years in prison for something that involved a bunch of convicts in a room over baseball cards. Yeah, there were guns. None of them went off. It really was kind of an almost non-event, but you know, he forced them to go the whole nine yards. I'm sure they wanted to do a plea deal with him, but he wouldn't do it. So it did get to be too big, much bigger than it should have been, but there's only one person to blame for that, and that's Simpson himself.
Art, your thoughts?
I think it's a great point. It's you know, whether you believe in it or not, you know, karma eventually may have a way of coming around and righting itself. And there's just so much irony here, and driven by this giant character defect in OJ that he, you know, may have been an asset when he was on this side of the law, but once he went on the other side and still had this overconfidence and this giant ego and hubris, you know, and feeling untouchable, you know, one thing that I would slightly differ with Peter here, I think OJ thought he was going to get away with this. I don't think he may have imagined the publicity that would come out of it. Some others may have, like Riccio, who helped stage it. But, you know, I think he felt, hey, you know, I'm entitled. These guys have my stuff. I'm going to get it back because, you know, they've stolen it from me, and I'm justified in holding them up for it like I was justified in killing, Nicole Brown Simpson and Fred Goldman's son, who's a great kid, you know, and he went after it with that sort of rationale and, you know, once again, overconfidence and, you know, the gang that couldn't shoot straight brought him down.
Yeah, so I do agree that when he went there, he really firmly believed he was going to be able to get away with it and he was going to look good doing it. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, and so you know, in the end, he's probably exactly where he should be. However circuitous the route, Simon, and I got to applaud you know, the tenacity and commitment of Peter and Peter Haven and the defense team and the you know, the lawyers behind the Goldmans, because I have, you know, seen them over the years and the pain and suffering that this family has had to endure over and over and every day and live with. I mean, it's just unfathomable. You know, they love
yeah,
this.
I've spoken to the Goldmans a couple of times, and it is such a sad, and actually, you know, it should never have happened.
Yep.
You know, this is someone that has taken matters into their own hands, and an innocent life was destroyed. You know,
once again, yes, good. Yeah, well, yeah, and it's because OJ, you know, thought that Nicole was his possession, and that no one should have any rights to enjoy what he had, quote, created or, you know, funded her magnificence. So whether, you know, she was driving the Ferrari and he spied Ron Goldman driving it, he'd paid for her breast augmentation, and no man should be able to see that. I mean, you know, you had this twisted sort of, you know, justification going on in his mind that this is mine, and same thing in the hotel room in Las Vegas. And you know, eventually, that me, the giant, larger than life, OJ, you know, the scorpion, you know, stung itself.
I'm going to bring on one more person here. I've kind of left her out of the game today. Pickles, are you still with us?
I'm just listening and absorbing everything. See, my mother watched like all the OJ stuff when I was younger, and I'm just kind of listening to everything. It's just so interesting to hear from this side. And are you still talking about the appeal?
I'm sorry, you're talking to me about the appeal?
I was just wondering if that's what you guys were still going around about, was everybody's view on the appeals. I kind of just started was listening and got lost.
Yeah, well, the appeal will be handled, in effect, by the prosecutor's office, because they're the parties to the appeal. I have no involvement with the appeal.
I just don't see it going through.
I think the appeal's going nowhere.
The appeal was generated by Yale to basically get himself some more publicity, and that's its primary purpose, and it will achieve some degree of purpose there. But even Yale's milked this publicity thing for as much as he can get out of it. I think even he can't do much more with it.
Okay, we're pretty much out of time here, but I'd like to go round the table and get some wrap-up thoughts. Peter, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think that as much as we can try to close a chapter in legal history, I think we've done it. And there have been a tremendous – people sort of were upset with the legal system for not getting this right the first time. But really, I'm not so sure the legal system ever did anything wrong. And I think what you've seen over the last 10 or 15 years is a massive effort by a lot of devoted lawyers and legal personnel, not just me, but many, many others. Petrocelli, his people, some of my colleagues, the prosecuting team in Vegas, and a lot of great judges along the way, Judge Glass in Vegas, Judge Rosenberg here in California, and ultimately, justice was served, in my opinion.
Art.
Yeah, I agree with, you know, with Peter, as much as at the time so much of the world was polarized and there was this terrible racial divide, over this initial verdict, I think over the years, and especially ironically with the election of President Obama, this racial divide has healed in many ways, and I think that hopefully in the African American community there's a sense that if not justice for all, it is certainly a lot closer than it was in the perception of the jury that sat in on OJ. And so, it's fascinating to look back and see, number one, how he reached out to the people he left behind long ago to save him, ironically, and now those people, I think many of African Americans would feel that that justice was done here and would not object to OJ as being a target of racism or a racist justice system. So I think, looking back, it's a positive chapter.
It's an interesting chapter in that it really does show, at least in my mind, that justice will eventually get done, which I think was what Peter was telling me yesterday.
Well, we'll see if it happens in the Peterson saga. I think you're going to see a similar thing unfold.
Oh, okay. We have about 15 minutes left on the show. Let's talk Peterson.
Oh, yeah. That guy.
Okay. You brought it up. You kick it off.
Well, I think you're seeing this is a story that's frequently repeated in our world, and it's not just in the legal system, it's in all aspects of our lives. I mean, we try to do things, we try to do them well. Sometimes we don't do things perfectly, but if we keep trying, we eventually get it right. And in the legal system, what you see are a lot of these guys, people, who commit horrible crimes, and for one reason or another, they seem to get away with it. Simpson was one. Most recently, we had Spector here in Los Angeles, and he seemed to get away with it, but the system kept trying, and he just got basically a life sentence just yesterday, I think, or 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. And now you have another example of this. You have this Drew Peterson character in Illinois who certainly looks like a guilty man. His third wife was killed under very mysterious circumstances. He was a police officer. A lot of parallels with OJ. Apparently, he's very charismatic. Apparently, people like him. And he basically, if he committed the murder of his third wife, and there's a lot of evidence that suggests he did, if he did it, he got away with it. But apparently, getting away with it and getting off and having a free life after doing something horrible like that wasn't enough. And he seems to just thumb his nose at the system, just like you-know-who we were just discussing. His fourth wife disappears, and, when someone just disappears like that, there's certainly a strong inference that they've been murdered. And he acts like a guy who basically thinks this is all some great big joke. He certainly doesn't act like a guy who's innocent. An innocent man, in my opinion, wouldn't behave at all like this. And lo and behold, He's really stuck himself out there, and now the Illinois prosecutors are gathering together, and they're going to try to put him on murder trial again for the murder of his third wife. And they have a lot of things to overcome. They've got some problems they have to overcome, and we could talk about those. But it's the system. You have one guy on one side who just won't stop standing out and doing things that put him in harm's way and thumb his nose at the legal process and the justice that tries to keep all of us at peace. And on the other hand, you have a system as tired and frustrating and difficult as it is, that just keeps trying. And we'll see if it results in justice this time around, because I think they're going to try him again. And my gut tells me they're going to get a conviction. That's my gut response. But, you know, we'll see how the jury trial actually unfolds.
Actually, I read an interesting article. Apparently a few days ago, he actually had the gall to make a reverse charge call to a radio station and made a few jokes. We do have a caller coming in, and please bear with us until we get to you. Art, have you been following the Drew Peterson story at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, from a little bit of a distance, but I am fascinated, once again, as Peter said, somebody who thinks he can get a murderer, you know, thought he got away with one, hey, let's try it again. You know, divorce is too expensive. Let's make it happen ourselves, and then, I'm a cop. I could never do this. I mean, I've got bad luck. All my wives keep dying.
Yeah, exactly.
Is he the victim? I mean, he certainly was playing it, but maybe not as well as OJ, because he couldn't stop smiling. So I think that eventually, if the DNA works and they do some forensics, are get better and better all the time, and there's so much circumstantial stuff that I think will eventually come out, that justice will eventually prevail.
I think that's true about the circumstantial stuff, yeah.
Let's skip to the switchboard here. We have someone coming in, I'm guessing from Skype, from the infamous 111 area code. What's your name and what's your question for us?
This is Jan, and I'm calling about the radio station that he called. He called Collect at the request of Mancow, and he was cutting jokes, and a couple of the jokes that he made was instead of having a date with Drew, they can have conjugal visits with Drew, which was in very poor taste. But
not funny.
It was, yeah. And the other
diabolical,
one was
diabolical, and he's just diabolical, and he needs to.
And he was talking about the food and how bad it is.
And he needs the death penalty.
Hang on, we seem to have some static. Okay, carry on, caller.
Oh, I'm sorry. And he was calling with jokes like that. When conjugal visits, and about the food and how well they're treating him, and how that, you know, he's afraid to be taking a shower, and just real, real ignorant man.
Well, do you think he's a guilty man?
I had met him once when I was a police officer back home in Chicago, and yes, he is a snake, and I can tell you, the thing that set it off for me was, if you were dropping off the kids and you were at the door, why would you wait for a locksmith? Why would you not bust down the door?
Yeah.
Very good.
No. You want to have a witness present who will be there to record your shock and amazement at seeing this happen.
But he never went in. He had the friend go in.
Well,
but even if he could have had the guy there, but they waited for the locksmith. They didn't break down the door.
In my opinion, I think that's a very good point. I wasn't aware of precisely those facts, but if those were the facts, you're absolutely right. That's a very profound omission on his part. You kick it down. All the conduct of this person is consistent. It's not consistent with an innocent state of mind. Even if you didn't commit this crime, you would still know that the mother of your children, your wife for however many years, was dead, and people thought you did it. You wouldn't be joking. I mean, if you were really innocent, for one thing, you would feel bad for the mother of your children dying, but you really wouldn't. You'd recognize her family and her loved ones. you wouldn't be making jokes about this. You wouldn't be thumbing your nose at the system. And that's what these guys do. And it's partly ego, but it really makes me wonder if at some level they're not sort of wanting to be caught. I just don't know. I'm really speculating. But their conduct is so outrageous that I don't think it's just a function of ego. I think there's a part of them that's almost going to keep doing this until they get caught, and they seem to almost want to get caught.
Something else I think, you know, you got to compare him with O.J. I think they're both, people would say, experts, that they're sociopathic, and the empathy gene is not in their system, so that they don't feel the pain of others, because you know, they're basically constructed to be as selfish as they can be, and you know, so you know, you can't expect, you know, an automaton to be human.
That's a very good point.
And the fact that he doesn't let the children of Savio visit with her family, and if they do, he's constantly right there. They can't ask, you know, how you doing, what's going on. He's got the kids so brainwashed. And, you know, if you have nothing to hide and you didn't do anything, why would you be so worried about what the children will say?
Well, that's another series of interesting comments that were just made there. One is, you know, in these situations, both Simpson and Peterson, you know, it certainly looks like the husband and the father killed the wife and mother. And yet, because he was not convicted of the crime, he gets to have custody of the children. So he gets custody and control of the children. The point you made about if you were really innocent, why wouldn't you just let these children do what they want? And I think your answer is obvious. He's trying to maintain control over these children. They're important to his survival. In fact, one of these children is going to basically provide him with an alibi if there is a second trial. And then the third point I want to briefly touch upon is this empathy issue. It was just mentioned. I think that's a very important point. There are some people in the world, and you know, if you see someone fall on the pavement and you see them hit their head or land hard on their bottom, you almost wince because you're like, oh, God, that must have hurt, and you feel for them. And most human beings have that empathetic response. You see something like that, and you feel it. You feel it like, oh, God, I hope they're okay. And there are some people who walk among us, and they look like us, and they sound like us, and they talk like us. In many respects, they have higher character traits than you can imagine, but they don't feel that empathetic response. And it's difficult in their minds to look at people as anything other than, you know, chess pieces, objects, whatever you want to call it. And both Peterson and Simpson and a lot of other people demonstrate these kind of lack of empathetic responses. It makes them dangerous. But they're also very good at getting people to like them, and that makes them doubly dangerous because, you know, the guy you let through the door and invite into your life and embrace can do you infinitely more harm than the guy you see walking down the street who you know you're never going to let in your door because he's broadcasting to the whole world that he's trouble. These guys, these snakes as you call them, they're very dangerous, and they do exist among us, and we all have to be kind of aware of that.
And the fact that he's going to lose a lot of money, you know, 2 days before the trial or before the divorce was going to be final,
yeah,
he was going to be losing a lot, and that makes it,
that's
you
what
know.
That goes to what we call motive.
Yeah.
When they prosecute him, they're going to, one of the things you have to show is motive. I mean, somebody's dead. You, in addition to showing that you killed this person, you have to show that you had a reason to kill them. And that evidence, the fact that he gained significantly financially as a result of her death, certainly goes to motive.
Now, do you think if they did the retrial of Simpson, hypothetically, let's say, you know, they didn't have him at that time and they tried him now, do you think he would have been convicted for the murder?
I'm sorry, retrial of who?
Like, hypothetically, what I'm saying is, let's say it was a cold case for Simpson, and then they finally got the evidence against him to charge him, and he went to trial for these murders now, do you believe that he would have been found guilty?
Yes, yes. I really think that, you know, people seize upon certain jury verdicts as examples of how the system sucks and it's broken. And the Simpson verdict is one of those verdicts. And I'm not sure it really does indicate that the system's broken. Again, that's a whole other topic, but I'm not sure that that verdict indicated that the system didn't work. Again, there was a huge community that had strong beliefs, and they exercised those beliefs. But be that as it may, that verdict, his ability to get that result was really a perfect timed event in a social chapter, in a city, in a community. I mean, that kind of alignment of the stars, legal stars, so to speak, just doesn't happen very often. I think at any other time, in any other place, in any other setting, I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. There's no question in my mind, personally, that he would have been convicted and found guilty, whether it was a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later. It was really, that was an island in a great big legal sea that he managed to land on at just the right time in just the right place. And that's
okay. I hate to break in here. My producer is now whining seriously in my ear. I have to wrap this show up. We've lost TJ Hart. I'm guessing his cell phone battery died, but I do want to thank TJ. I especially want to thank Art Harris. Art, thank you so much for being on here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Simon. It's really an honor to be on with such a dedicated and justice-seeking attorney, and I hope he gives the Goldman our best wishes.
Oh,
I'm
sure Peter will. And Peter Haven, I don't know what to say to you. You know, thank you so much, and I would love to talk to you again about the Drew Peterson case. We were just starting to get into it when the show ended. I mean, we were just starting.
Well, I'm sorry if I spoke too long about all these topics. I find them all very interesting. I'm very grateful to be on the show, and I'm happy to talk with you and everybody else whenever you want. Thank you very much.
Oh, Peter, you can guarantee that we will be talking again in the next couple of days. We'll organize another go-round. Pickles, you were quiet today.
No, it's so unlike me. I just listened and learned so much. Thank you for letting me be here.
Oh, it is our pleasure. And I'd like to put out special thanks to our stenographer, Jan.
Thank you.
I'm sure she has a writing cramp right now.
Right.
A little bit, yeah.
Right. I mean, everyone needs someone to take notes. And Jam was it. I'm not quite sure what happened to Denny.
Oh, I thought he was still there.
Nope. I think Denny got lost in the lost in the ether somewhere. But you know, I'm sure Denny will be here tomorrow. And on that note, we will have another show tomorrow, and we're going to be discussing the Haley Cummings case, and who knows what else. And that will be at the same time, 3 p.m. Central. So this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great Saturday. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for taking part. Thank you so much for calling in. And we will talk to you all again soon. Have a great day. Goodbye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Peter.